Welcome to this class. I hope you already felt welcomed. On your handout, I think I have a slightly different title than is on the program, Growing Through Experience and Maintaining Energy, kind of the thoughts that I have as I think about growing as a teacher. How many of you have taught for 2 years, going in, 2 years, okay. How many of you, this is your first year? None, that's kind of what I expected. How many of you taught more than 2 years? And more than 3 years? More than 4 years? Excellent. Okay, so I'm glad to know who I'm talking to a little bit. So when I think of teaching, specifically teaching long-term, which, what does that mean? Are you a career teacher yet if you've taught 10 years or 20 years? Are you? I don't know. It's a state of mind more than anything, I think. But when I think of teaching long-term, I have used this illustration, but it's one of my favorites. I like to think of a long hike, taking a long hike. And if I was able to take off and do something sort of pointless for a few months, I would love to go and hike the AT, the Appalachian Trail, which stretches from Springer Mountain in Georgia all the way to, it's Mount Katahdin in Maine. And I've hiked a little bit of it, and I'm so intrigued with the trail. But most people have this rosy impression of that experience, you know, being out with nature for months at a time, and just all these beautiful views. And there is that. And most through hikers start at Springer Mountain in Georgia in early spring with enthusiasm and very heavy packs because they bring everything along that they want for a nice trip. I've seen things like teddy bears in packs and luxury food items, carbonated beverages, and all kinds of things like that. I haven't actually been there and seen that, but in documentaries and things. It's astonishing how many people drop out in the first few days. there's different funny stories about a person. There's one person in particular who bought all the gear, flew all the way from somewhere in Oregon or something like that. Long ways, flew down there. It wasn't me, no. And hired a taxi to take him to the trailhead, and there was a phone booth set up a couple miles into the trail, and the taxi service is represented on that phone booth because quite a few people call and they're done after a few miles. Well, you know, it's like 2,100 miles total. But 2 or 3 miles, that was it. Well, sure enough, this guy called and said, no, he's done. He's going home. So the taxi picked him up and took him back to his hotel. And the next morning, this fellow called the taxi again from his hotel. And he said, my wife said I bought all this equipment. I have to go do it. So he goes back to the trailhead. And the taxi driver dropped him off. And sure enough, not too long later, he gets another call, and he goes and picks him up again, and this time the guy's ready to go to the airport. And the taxi driver asked him, "This is a true story, by the way." He said, "Where? What are you going to do? What's your wife going to say?" He said, "I don't know. I'm not going home." So, there are a lot of people that get disillusioned with the trail. It's a lot harder than they thought. They expected it to be hard, but they didn't expect it to be so steep and rocky. I forget how many times on the Appalachian Trail, you know how high Mount Everest is, 29,000 feet? You climb that distance 130 times or something like that on the Appalachian Trail. It's hard. You meet all kinds of unexpected difficulties. You have lots of rain if you go through Great Smoky Mountain National Park. It's so beautiful. but it just rains all the time. And when it rains for 2 weeks, you know, you brought rain gear, you're all ready. But it's not fun to walk in rain gear. It's annoying, that swishing sound, and it's just not fun. I think teaching school is a lot like that. You will find, and you have found, that the obstacles maybe are a little different than you expected. And your vision and your high ideals, you know what? You're carrying a lot of stuff with you that is not helpful. That's one of the things I was thinking about with the trail. People start with heavy packs, and it is amazing what you throw away after just a few miles. You know, that actually is not going to be helpful. This is not helpful. Those heavy cans of pork and beans or whatever, those get tossed. There's not that much value. And it is that way, too, as we start teaching, unfortunately. There's some things we just can't get all the stuff done. It's all these great ideas and great programs and stuff. Eventually, you can't get everything done. So I think about teaching school and being the motivated teacher up front. I like this quote that a good teacher is like a candle, consumes itself in order to light the way for others. But then, you know, a candle does run out occasionally. What do you do at that point? So I want to think, especially in the session of keeping your fire lit, keeping the fire in your teaching, so probably some overlap with what Steve was talking about. Fire is something that's attractive. It's destructive too, but it can be very attractive. First thing that I wrote down is that there are no Christian schools without teachers who are actively following Christ in their life, making him a part of your everyday conversation and life, being involved with him. And you might ask, why is this your first point on growing as a teacher? One of the great stresses for me in teaching school, and I suspect for many people, is taking on myself the work that God will do. So I cannot make the choices for my students. And I think I talked about this already here somewhere. But so often, you see the choice that a student should make, and you want to make it for them. But you actually can't. And you have to actually be all right with that and let God do the work that he has promised to do. And you do the work that you're promised to do. Okay, so that's a big thing. And we're all familiar with the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I was struck again recently by that last phrase. That's what's difficult sometimes, is to know the wisdom to know the difference. And of course, there's all kinds of interesting parodies of that prayer too, about avoiding the people you don't really want to talk to in the first place. But anyway, that's not what we're talking about. So there's all kinds of things that you'll face. You can't change. Smile, relax, and just be all right with those things. Okay, so number one, keep your heart in your work. Great teachers teach from the heart. And I know there's so much overlap with what was said this morning, but I hope you understand that's because it's important. It really is, and it's easy to forget. This is a great big general statement to say, keep your heart in your work. What does that mean? Well, it means different things for different people. There are some ways I believe help to keep our heart in our teaching. So number one, A, I think I have it on your handout. Remember whom you are serving. If you're called to teach, you're called to serve. You're there to serve who? God, okay. That wasn't what I had on my handout. Perfect answer, though. Excellent.
Community.
The community, yes.
Students.
Your students. The parents. Well, all of those, yes. But in the end, you're there for the students. they're the reason you're there. You can have good relations with the parents, and you can be a wonderful person. But without students, you don't have a job. So that's who you're there to serve. So is the way you're living your life, are the choices that you're making with your life, are they serving the children in your school? Teaching from the heart will reach the heart. So let's think again, just thinking again about fire. Fire brings energy into a situation. That's why it's used as an analogy so often. There's fire in his eyes. That's a good thing or a bad thing sometimes, but there's energy there. How do we bring energy into our classroom? We have to be positive. We have to be enthusiastic about life in school, in the classroom, and on the playground. There's lots and lots of times that I've been enthusiastic, and my students have not been. And I've come to believe that enthusiasm and positivity is effective. It's about, well, I don't know, 30% effective, maybe. Hopefully 50% some days. But negativity is 100% effective. Huh, that's unfortunate. We have to harness their energy, the students' energy, if we can. And C is to maintain a tough skin and a soft heart. Let us not be easily offended, because when we're offended, we're not growing very well. Let's be able to take some criticism. Understand that it's usually coming from a good place. It's usually coming from a caring heart. Not always. Oh, who was mentioning it yesterday? I think it was Aaron that I heard mention about the teacher being corrected by the students. Do you enjoy that?
No.
No? Yeah. Especially depending on the attitude of the corrector, right? But you show your character a little bit in how you a lot in how you respond to that. Okay, and I know I look back in horror at some of the ways that I responded to that criticism. When they were right, they were wrong in the way they did it, but they were right about, you know, the facts. Okay. Great peace have those that love thy law. Nothing shall offend them. That's the sign of somebody who's willing to grow. Okay, and the second point that I have here, main point, is to pursue excellence. I have believed that everybody should be truly excellent at one thing, at least. What would you, if you look at your own life, what would you say that I am excellent at this? This made perfect sense to me when I wrote it down. And as I was thinking about it recently, well, I'm not excellent at anything. But I'm pursuing excellence. I'm still pursuing excellence. And that's the difference, I think. So, but think about your life as a teacher and the things that you do teaching school and also your life outside of school, because that really, really makes a difference. What is it that you're truly excellent? Now, I can look at some of you, and I know you reasonably well, some of you. Steve comes to mind because I grew up with him, sort of, and worked with him, and my dad. And I can think of things that you are excellent at. Just a really obscure one that you're not going to expect here. But my dad was the best shot with a .22 that I've ever seen. he could take his Ruger 10-22 with a scope on it and would take a tiny little pebble and throw it up and just shoot it out of the air nearly every time. I don't know how often you can do it now, but you used to be able to do that. Yeah, well, you were pretty lucky. And I remember seeing younger guys come along and, I'm gonna do that and just shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot and just couldn't miss anything. The rocks got bigger and bigger. And anyway, so Dad was an inspiration in that way, and lots and lots of other ways too. One of the things that I that I think about as I think about excellence. We often get burned out as teachers because we stop pursuing excellence. Okay? We're doing the same thing over and over and not really improving. And we don't, just like our students, if our students are never successful, they get really tired of school. And we are the same way. If we are not experiencing success somewhere, we're gonna get burned out. So it's important that we chase excellence, because as teachers, we're role models, like it or not. There's a quote, I don't remember who said it first, but it says, "Everyone is looking for someone to look up to, something to look forward to, and someone to chase." I like that. So you probably are the person that someone is chasing. You might not realize that, how much that is true in your life, but I know that's true. There are people in my life that I am chasing still. There's a study, too, as we think about pursuit of excellence. There's a study by Anders Ericsson that was became a lot more popular when Malcolm Gladwell published the findings in this report. And I don't actually remember which book that was. Was it Tipping Point, Blink, one of those, where he talked about the...
Outliers.
Was it Outliers? Okay. Where he talked about the 10 years, 10,000 hours. How many of you are familiar with that concept, idea, whatever? Yeah. So this idea is that to become really an expert at anything, it takes 10 years or 10,000 hours of practice. And there's a lot of people really latched on to this idea. Now, it's been discredited by Anders Ericsson himself. He said, "I was misrepresented there a little bit." There is definitely such a thing as innate ability, natural ability. And so it's just not true in every case. But there is still a fair amount of evidence that that is what produces most experts, as I understand it, is somebody that has actually just practiced it and continued to practice and looked for ways to get better at it. I think that's really the big thing. So sometimes, if you just need to keep showing up. history is made by the people that show up. If you're not there, you're just not making an impact. So I like that thought too. To continue to grow as a teacher, you actually have to continue teaching. Remember that. I also think that a sense of humor is vital. I've mentioned this. Humor is the shock absorber of life. And it's not just about being funny, it's about not being offended, like we said. Okay, so B then is to keep studying new subjects. Let's see, how many of you just really love algebra, math or algebra? Okay, good. So not as many hands on algebra as on math, but that's good. I didn't know anything about algebra when I started teaching. Well, I'd taken it in school. But it was just this hazy, cloudy subject that meant almost nothing. I knew I would never, ever use it in life, never need to know it again, put as little effort in as possible. And then I took it in school, and it made no sense at all, and I was supposed to make it make sense. And so I concentrated very hard 1 year, and it came alive to me. And I saw how algebra is represented in the world all around us and how vital it is for development in science and things. So, yeah, it's true, you may never use it in science, in real life. But the fellow who develops the app that will replace your job will probably be using it. So, I really enjoy algebra now. I look forward to it, because we don't teach it every year at our school. We teach it every other year in combined classes. So keep studying new subjects. And I realized when I was teaching, too, that science, this is funny, because I'm supposed to teach science here later on. Science was also a hazy subject for me, because I liked it. It's interesting. But frankly, we didn't have, there wasn't much focus on science when I was in school. And so it was always interesting, always interested in new developments and phenomena and things like that. But I didn't have a grasp on it at all. And I realized that I'm passing that on to my students. And so one year, again, I focused on learning science. Now, unfortunately, that was about 12 years ago, and I've gotten lazy, and so I forget some things now. So it's time for me to sharpen up on it again. Study new subjects. Biology, for me, too, was something that I had to really work on. Now, I was saying my title or my entry here was new subjects. What I mean by that is specifically the subjects in which your grasp is limited, not your natural bent, if that makes sense. I was always interested in history, which is funny because our history in school was pretty bad. It wasn't that interesting. But it wasn't hard for me to study history because history is basically stories. It's the story of man and his relationship with God and the environment and different things, and how they've succeeded and failed, and human conflict, and romance. There's all kinds of things in history that are beautiful. Basically, if you like stories, you like history. How could you not like history? That's the way I looked at things. So history was easy for me to study and hard to teach. So I still work on that one, definitely. I work on all of them. Study new subjects and see, sharpen your old skills. Old tools become rusty without maintenance, just like I've mentioned. I've sensed in last year in particular that I was forgetting so many of these terms in biology and different things that I really need to go back and restudy those. So keep sharpening your old skills. D, keep an open mind about your methods here. There's a quote from Casby that I really liked. We should practice a healthy skepticism about our methods. And that's not just about the people in our church, but that's actually about us. Like what I'm doing. Am I skeptical that I'm doing it the best way? It's good for you to do that. You probably are doing something in your classroom last year and this next year that is not the most effective. Can you think about that? What is it? What is causing confusion? Maybe it worked well 3 years ago. You had a different group of students. But look at what you're doing and your students. And I think this is particularly true of those of us who have taught more than 10 years. We're just set up. Now, I know this works. Yeah, that young teacher, he's got this bright idea. He'll learn, you know. No, actually, he might have a great idea. You should try. You should listen to the first, second-year teachers who come with these bright ideas. Okay? Excellent. And the third point, major point here, is read. How many of you like to read? That is good. I see a few people who are sitting there sadly, though, without their hand. I'm not going to point you out or anything. My sympathies are with somebody who's teaching school and does not like to read. I know you can be a good teacher. But so much of my experience in learning to grow as a teacher came from reading what other people had done and experienced and their victories and their defeats in teaching school and in life. And I'm talking here. This whole talk is mostly from my own experience and drawing from others as well, but the things that have been most effective for me. So read the Bible. It is very important that you read the, and when I say read the Bible, I can just kind of hear, look at your eyes just glaze over, just molasses all the way back. Because you know you're supposed to read the Bible. We're told that in church. We read it in church. But it's vital that you as a teacher have a real connection with Scripture, and that you use it as inspiration, and your students, hopefully, will ask you questions. And why do we do this? Or what is it? what is predestination anyway? And what happens to us after we die exactly? Or they'll ask you a lot of questions. And it's so helpful if you have the basic scriptural or a great scriptural foundation for answering questions. And also, Dad mentioned it a little bit this morning too, how Jesus would answer a question. And in dealing with questions of theological nature, if you can learn to answer a question with a question, that is a wonderful way to draw them into a conversation. Okay, so read the Bible. Classics. B, a classic is a classic. Why? Well, for a reason. Many different reasons. But usually it touches something deep in the human psychic or spirit, however you want to say that. This is not a rule. There are some classics that are basically trash in my opinion. But most classics are classics for a good reason. And if a book has endured, it's an indication that it's probably worth your time. Les Miserables is a fantastic classic, in my opinion. I also love The Count of Monte Cristo. It's the greatest story of revenge that I've read, one of the greatest ones. And it's not just about revenge. It's about how the end, the protagonist, realizes what he's destroying with his fantastic acts of revenge. And he really changes at the end of the book. That's my take on that book. And I also love biographies. Read biographies. Sam Walton. I remember reading Sam Walton's biography when I was in school, and I found it fascinating. He's such an interesting character. If you just think of Walmart when you think of Sam Walton, and you know the how he changed so that the economy so everything comes from China. That's not Sam Walton at all. Do you remember what his motto was for his first stores for Walmart? It was Made in America. Made in America was their motto. He's a fantastic, interesting person. He was a pilot because he got tired of driving from his store in southern Arkansas, if I remember right, to one farther northern Arkansas. And he looked up one day while he was on this wiggly road, and the roads were a lot smaller back then. I think it took him 6 to 8 hours to drive from one store to the other. He had to do it several times a week. And he saw this Cessna going across. He went straight home and bought a Cessna. Didn't know how to fly it or anything. But he was a real go-getter, and he shortcutted his way through everything he needed to get his pilot's license, and got a pilot's license, and loved it. It saved so much time. But he was a bit of a careless pilot. He would often be up in the air and realize that he's low in fuel. And there's not a lot, it's pretty hilly and lots of trees in Arkansas. And one time he was dangerously low in fuel, and he flew over this abandoned airstrip, and he landed there. His son was with him that time, and he landed and he realized, and as he landed, that it's completely grown up. He landed and just kind of stopped there. And he went out, he found some fuel from a local there, and came back and dumped a few gallons in and started the plane again and tried to take off. And there was so much grass on the runway that he just couldn't get anywhere close to takeoff speed. So he circled back around and tried it again. It was a little bit faster that time. And still had to brake at the end and tip forward. And the fourth time down the runway, his son opened the door and jumped out. And he watched as his dad circled back around and took off. Anyway, Sam Walton is a very interesting character. And you find all kinds of these things through reading biographies. Okay, subject material. It's really wonderful if you are actively searching for current events, historical papers that are coming out, and advances in science, things like that. I am often on the lookout for advances in things like electric vehicles, because I'm interested in that. And we could have a good discussion about that. And I have lots of them at school. I think this is helpful. Be interested. Church history. Read books about church history. Okay, and I'm going to say contemporary nonfiction as well. This is an area of, it's just enormous. And there are so many wonderful books here that really help you to understand history and all the things that you need to teach in school. The Worst Hard Time is, I think, a must read about the Dust Bowl years and what actually created the Dust Bowl and why it could actually happen again, possibly because they're drilling wells deeper and deeper, and there's definitely a chance that the water table gets so low that they're not able to irrigate like they're doing right now, and then the farmers in that region are going to be stuck without water. And what's going to happen at that point? Easily could be another Dust Bowl. Waco. I remember when Waco happened. Vaguely, wasn't that interested in it, but I've been interested in it since then. Killers of the Flower Moon. How many of you have read that book? So that's a local, almost local story. Well, it's in Oklahoma, close enough. Very interesting story about the Native Americans and their interactions with the oil field, and that's fascinating. I really like to look for books that are set in my region. So I live in Oregon, Pacific Northwest, and there are fascinating stories from that region. The Egg and I by Betty McDonald, all of Betty McDonald's books, well, not all of them, but that one is set out there in the Pacific Northwest. The Boys in the Boat, fascinating story. I've driven really close to the boathouse there. If you've flown into Seattle, you've flown right over Lake Washington where they did their training in the Boys in the Boat. And actually, you can go do a tour of that thing. And you can actually see the shell that they use is there. And the book Eruption, which I found fascinating. That's about the eruption at Mount St. Helens. And, you know, I knew it was a big volcano and it was a big problem. But then I've talked to different people from that who were there. Paul Zare remembers it, and how it spread ash over Portland. And also, it's kind of interesting. So if we dig down in our area, like in my backyard, if we dig down a little ways, I forget how far down it is, but there'll be this thin layer of ash that you can see in the dirt line. That's in undisturbed dirt, of course. And that's ash from this volcano. And it's the stories of the loggers who were logging that mountain, and they knew this thing is probably going to erupt, but there was virgin timber there, these enormous logs, and the logging companies were desperate to get them off. And the waves in the ground, they would have these little mini earthquakes. And 3 foot high waves would ripple through there, and the trees would woof, woof, woof. And how the mountain bulged, there was a mile long bulge in that mountain that just boom, like an abscess. And they stayed there logging. It's amazing. Yeah. There's so many books like that. John Guyrock, if you like to fly fish, All the Time in the World. There's so many wonderful books. Anybody have a great book you would like to mention that you've read in the last year that everybody should read? If we have time later, I would love if you would tell me. Okay, children's books. Read children's books as well. I found it helpful to occasionally reread a book that I loved as a boy and just kind of remember the things the feelings that I got from that book and what it made me want to do or be. That's helpful. And I like to read books just for fun as well. I'm not sure if I have that on there. So there's books that I read just because I enjoy reading. Okay, I think I don't consider that a waste of time. Some people do, I know. I think my dad and I have slightly different opinions on that, but that's fine. Okay, and then my fourth main point here, rolling on. Cultivate a sense of wonder in the world. I've always liked this quote from Alex Trebek, who is the host of, what is it? It was a game show, which of course I've never watched. But it doesn't matter, anyway. But it's a type of game show where the contestants are asked questions, and if they can answer the question, then they go higher and then they make money or something like that. And I think they maybe competed against him. I'm not actually sure how that worked. But people asked him, how do you keep this going year after year after year? And he said, I'm interested in everything. Everything is interesting. And that is actually a good attitude for a teacher to have, that everything is interesting. Because your natural interests are likely not the same as your students. Find out what their interests are and pursue those things. I have learned so much from the interests of my students, trying to pick them up. I mentioned painting. Painting, oh, that was something that people did who didn't really have a life, right? Painting is amazing. It opens up the world to you in ways that you wouldn't have imagined. You will see the colors of a tree much more differently if you start trying to paint them. Okay. Develop new interests that can give new perspectives. That was actually the point there. B. And C, naivete and cynicism are equally unhelpful. We need to understand that we're not naive as teachers. We don't believe everything that comes along. Not everything is a great idea. But equally unhelpful, maybe even more so, is the stereotypical older teacher who's dour and just has no joy left in life, it seems like. Yeah. Okay, so the fifth point then is develop stimulating relationships with other teachers. And I think that's what you're doing here at this workshop event. Iron sharpeneth iron. Do we understand how a stone or a steel works? Specifically, a stone works by making contact with a knife, and it grinds down those edges. And a steel hones the edge, or if you could look at a microscopic view of it, so that those sharp edges actually kind of fold over like this, enlarged to show detail. And so that steel, if you use it, it bends those edges back like this, back into alignment. And I see both illustrations being, actually I think a better illustration is it's like this, right? Mm-hmm. And a steel bends them back like that, okay? And I see that illustration reflected in my interactions with teachers, how they've told me different times, that's a dumb idea, that's a little bit like the stone grinding it off. And then just giving helpful tips to help just kind of realign your vision again. I like that. Now, I believe that professional chefs say, a dull knife is a dangerous knife because it takes so much more effort. You'll have to exert more pressure, and the chances that something will slip are much higher. There was a French chef that I remember reading some of his, he had a book, actually. He was demonstrating the proper technique for knife sharpening because it says it's very, very important when you're cutting onions that your knife is sharp. If your knife is sharp, you don't use as much pressure, and the onion does not release as much of the chemical, which I think is propanthenol S oxide. Okay, so it releases that chemical into the air. When you push hard, it breaks a lot more of those little cells, and the chemical pops into the air and gets in your eyes. And so he said, the sharper your knife, the less you cry. That's true in teaching as well. The more you hone your technique, the less you cry. Yeah. So we can learn from other teachers if we are humble enough to do it, and it makes us sharper. John Mark Coons told me at Faith Builders, good and this is not original with him, but I'm going to borrow it from him. Good teachers borrow politely from other teachers. Great teachers steal with both hands. So use the things that other teachers are using that are working. And when I get together with a group of teachers, I always hear something, and I always expect to hear something that makes me think, hey, I'm going to try that. Keep that mindset. So as teachers, an email or chat group can be helpful. Communicate with other teachers in different ways. I have a lot of teachers in my contact who are friends, and I can send them a text or email. If I'm often when I'm asked to give a talk, I do that. Hey, what do you think about this thought? Is that completely random? Okay, then the sixth point here is to rest and recreate. Make sure that you do have a life outside of school, understanding that's not your biggest life, maybe. Your students do have that life outside of school. And it really helps if you to relate if you have some other experience. Spend time outdoors in all weather. Make time to be outside. Actually, like outside all the buildings. Nature has a power to de-stress us and make us think more deeply. And it's most powerful when it's enjoyed without earbuds. We need sunshine and rest and water. Basically, we're houseplants with complicated emotions. That's a quote that I've heard recently. For myself, following in the footsteps of the disciples, I go a-fishing. And Thoreau has said many people go fishing all their lives without knowing it is not fish that they are after. So you don't have to go fishing, but there is a wonderfully restorative thing in being in the outsides, in the outdoors. And again, connecting it with interests that that your students might have, one of the things that I started doing at the age of 40 was I started going to snowboarding and skiing, which I had absolutely no interest in that. Why would you do that when you could go fishing? But one of my sons thought it would be fun to do it for his birthday, and so we went, I'll try it once. I'll try anything once. So we went. It was amazing. I loved it. I skied way too fast down the hill and crashed, and I didn't get hurt. And so that gave me confidence. And I was really just... I just love the whole experience. So I have 1 minute. I love the whole experience of being in the mountains, the absolute beauty and the cold air and kind of the thrill. I definitely enjoyed the thrill and the speed and all that and the interaction that I had with my students. And that's what I was starting to say. My students were really into this, and some of them. And I really connected with them that year over this thing. So pursue something like that is really helpful. Learn to say no. How do you say no? We're all mortal and we have limitations. We cannot be, as Paul says, all things to all men, always. Although he does say that in a positive way, I understand. It's fine to say no sometimes to worthwhile things. And, okay. There was just one or two things I wanted to remember here. One that I just jotted down in pencil this morning, so it's not on your handout, is posture. Does that matter as a teacher and growing as a teacher? It's a little health thing That is a really, really big thing. And it was brought home to me when I went to a chiropractor, and he showed me, well, he said, what are you doing? How do you hold your phone? And, well, like a normal person does, it's right here. He said, put it up here. For one thing, you won't do it as long. And when you tip your head forward, you put a tremendous amount of weight on your spine, and that causes stress, and it translates into the rest of your body. So it's a really good thing to remember. What do you remember what Jordan Peterson's first rule in 12 Rules for Life is? Yes. Stand up straight with your shoulders back. Yes, and he used the illustration of crabs. Yep. And it's not a positive illustration either. But we can definitely get that way. And as you get more and more that way, I think your teaching will actually suffer a little bit. So it's a minor detail, I understand. And I would just say, along with that, screen time. You all understand that screen time is bad for children. How many of you grew up with a fair amount of screen time? Raise your hand. Okay, so we have one or so. I kind of expected more, but I expect with the younger teachers there would be more. But you're actually the ones I want to talk to. And that is, if we didn't grow up with it, we started doing it as adults, probably a fair amount. And you're probably overdoing it. Now, I'm not talking about the person sitting next to you. I'm talking about you. Okay? And that means me. I was just understanding that I have too much screen time. And it's affecting the way that I think and the way that I teach and all that. It's just making me obsessive about some things, frankly. So watch your screen time. And also, in closing, the end of the Appalachian Trail is on top of Mount Katahdin in Baxter, Maine. It's a difficult hike to the top. On the list of mountains that I'd like to climb, it's at least at number 5 or so, top 5. It's a difficult hike. It's not that terribly high, but it's just a tricky hike. And there's a beautiful view at the top. And you might see, well, this is difficult. You might see a difficult mountain ahead of you. And you think to yourself, that's it. So that's it. That's the end of the trail. I'm done. Excuse me. That's my Mount Katahdin there. I'm just over. But don't be too hasty. Might just be another mountain. Might just be another mountain with a great view. So there's many peaks on the AT, and the views are wonderful. And you might miss it more than you realize when you're finished. So keep going. Thank you for your attention.